Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks, Vago. Good to be here.
Great to be here, Vago.
It's always a treat. Okay, more 737 MAX news flow this week about stuff that's upcoming, work that Boeing has been doing to the airplane, as well as some airline concerns as well. And then the great New York Times story about how apparently the airplane simulators don't behave like the original airplane. Ron, give us a little bit of a roundup to start the conversation.
The FAA will be hosting a meeting, a roundtable with global regulators. Presumably, EASA will be there. Transport Canada will be there. The Brazilian authority. It's unclear right now if the Chinese authority will be there. But it's May 23rd, and it's potentially an important meeting because it may offer at least a framework for a way forward in the regions, you know, outside of the U.S. And I think that's important at this point because that's still one of the probably the broader uncertainties about the aircraft going back into service. So that's one piece of news this week. Two, it came out in from Boeing, in fact, that they'll be submitting the fix and changes to the training procedure to the FAA, at least for preliminary approval. And the thinking is that might happen, you know, before the May 23rd meeting, around the May 23rd meeting. And then there's probably a couple months after that, at least my understanding, to get final approval. So that was the other thing that came out this week. And then just to remind everybody, there was also the hearing on the Hill with the FAA, where they kind of went through, you know, what was going on at the FAA and certification of the aircraft and the process. So those were the big news of the week.
Sash, your take on the weekend developments and what you have to add to the news flow?
I mean, I'll start just by repeating what I've said for many weeks, which is if the Chinese aren't turning up, then between 30 and 40% of the MAX market has just closed up. And you can say it's trade wars. You can say it's the Chinese being hypersensitive about airline safety. I'd say it's probably a mix of both of those. But, you know, the Chinese are the single most important guests at that meeting. And if they don't turn up, then that tells us there's going to be a much bigger delay in terms of the ramp of the MAX, assuming it comes back into service. It probably won't leave 42 a month for a while.
Your take, and especially how you thought, and I want to get your take on how you guys thought that hearing went as well, because there were a couple of tense moments at it. Richard?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's hugely important, of course, to get everyone on board. I'm not completely convinced that the other international regulators, particularly China, will depoliticize this, especially given everything that's going on in the background. You know, I think we need to pay attention to the sort of, not just the trade war, but what's going on with Huawei. You know, the U.S., the Trump administration has made Huawei a bit of an enemy here. And Huawei is roughly the same size as Boeing. It's quite easy to see how these things could be linked in the Chinese government's minds. So that's an area of concern.
That's absolutely true, right? I mean, whether or not you think that what Huawei is doing is good or bad, obviously there's an intelligence component to it. There always is. I mean, the United States was, just like the Brits before them, the United States was a telecommunications leader because it allows you to listen to the traffic that's coming off of your equipment. Oftentimes, I mean, the way we do it, I think, is a little more legally because we strike agreements with host governments in order to do that. I have no idea whether or not Huawei is doing the same sort of thing. On the other hand, I think we've seen a couple of things come out through WikiLeaks or the Snowden papers or whatever that indicated that actually some of the host governments didn't know what we were doing using our telecoms gears. But how does the trade war ultimately, you know, this might be a good opportunity actually to talk for a second about the trade war because all of you now have brought this up. Ultimately, how does this trade war play out, Ron, and how is the market receiving this? at the moment, because we've been talking about this on and off. It became background noise. The noise with Mexico and Canada became so loud that the president basically, I think it's fair to say, capitulated. We didn't solve anything. Tariffs were imposed, nothing changes, and then tariffs were taken away. You know, how is all of this playing on the street? And I want to get all of your thoughts on this as well.
Well, in the most simple terms, when, you know, an agreement didn't come to pass and tariffs did, the market sold off pretty hard, right? So, you know, I think, you know, the market, at least at first, maybe wasn't fully expecting it. But then what we've seen since is the markets come back, right? So, you know, there, I think there's some level of, what's the word, you know, the market's been kind of desensitized to what's going on. And I think there is a prevailing view, ultimately, if we get into a bit of a protracted trade war, that it's worse for them than it is for us. And then it depends on, you know, kind of your exposure to it. Boeing, you know, was for sure when the administration announced that there would be, you know, an increased block of tariffs going out, you know, Boeing sold off pretty hard on that, you know, more so than the market. I think the market recognizes, you know, per Sash's previous point, that, you know, it's a very, very important end market for aviation. It's a very, very important end market for China, for Boeing. And ultimately, Boeing is our largest exporter, right? So it's our largest exporter to the one of their most important export markets, if not their most important export market. So I think there is, you know, clearly nervousness about it in the market.
Sash? Oh, no, go on. Richard, you had something?
Oh, sorry to interrupt, Sash.
No, not at all. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow on to that, I think there's actually quite a bit more upside than downside for Boeing here, because not only, as Ron says, are they about the biggest export market and Boeing the biggest exporter to China, manufactured exporter, at least if you don't count soybeans or pork or something, but it's, as a result, it's just inconceivable that there would be a negotiated trade settlement with the kind of shopping list that you typically see accompany negotiated trade settlements that didn't include Boeing jets. And frankly, they don't really have much of an appetite for twin aisles. They would have to be 737s. Now, countering that is the perception that this jet isn't loved by China's regulators. I would say it's the opposite. The speed with which China's regulators decertified this jet and then their double decertification a couple of weeks later, which is one of the bigger mysteries in regulation, means there was absolutely
It's like double. It's like double secret probation.
Double secret probation. That's right. Totally. It means there was no process at all. No data. No rigor. There was nothing harmed in the creation of that ruling, which means they should have no problem at all turning it on its head and ordering a bunch of jets. And as a result, if you believe there'll be a negotiated settlement by the end of the summer, and many people I know seem to think that's the case, then there's probably quite a lot of upside, because recertification coupled with a couple hundred orders for this jet would be really a shot in the arm for Boeing.
So ultimately, you think that their own demand for airplanes is going to be so insatiable that they will end up getting these airplanes anyway?
Well, you know, if they've got an intake of about 350 jets per year, almost all of them single aisles, if for some magical ability they transfer those all to Airbuses and Airbus has the bandwidth to produce that, there's no way Airbus wouldn't make them pay dearly for that. But China does not want to give Airbus that pricing power. And on top of that, you know, frankly, it chimerica, as Niall Ferguson termed it, is something that's worked extremely well for them. And the one way to get back in the U.S.'s good graces is to order a bunch of manufactured products. And whoops, we have no other manufactured exports to Asia of China of any magnitude aside from Boeing jets. So it has to be this. And, you know, I think there's such a strong case for this that the only way it could not happen is if something were to go wrong in Trump administration trade negotiations. Whoops, there, I said it. Yeah, something always seems to go wrong with Trump administration trade negotiations. But if it doesn't, then Boeing is probably in for a very strong endorsement.
Sash, your take?
I think there's a quite an interesting broad issue in terms of supply and demand in the particularly the narrow body airline market at the moment, which is that, yes, you know, Boeing clearly isn't producing MAXes at the moment, and the market is net short of about 50 aircraft a month, many of which are now piling up at airports around the US. But the thing that is, I mean, I'd highlight quite how bearish IATA was about the effects of trade war, the trade wars in the statement they put out on Friday. Probably more importantly, there's a whole bunch of what we would regard as being second line, second tier airlines, which are ceasing operations and releasing a lot of very, very new narrow-bodied aircraft onto the market. And just this year, we had, you know, WOW Air in Iceland, you know, Iceland's second carrier. Nobody should terribly care, but they had, you know, that was a Neo Max airline. Jet Airways in India, I mean, you know, had as modern a fleet as anybody could ask for, 737s predominantly. Nearly 120 aircraft are coming back onto the market as the lessors recover them. And the really interesting thing last week was the Anglo-German travel group, Thomas Cook. Basically, their airline is going bust, as far as we can see. They've got 120 more, predominantly A320neos and A320 Classics on the market. Those are all going to flood out as well. So I can actually see how Boeing's shortage of supply in the first, you know, six, 8 months of this year could be entirely absorbed by the market, because it's getting very, very new narrow bodies back from airlines that are ceasing production. And do remember that the Chinese use leasing companies very, very actively. They don't just buy direct. They tend to be about 50-50 direct purchases and leasing. So I think the lack of supply from Boeing can actually be absorbed for quite some time.
Ron, is that in your model at all about some of these airplanes? Because we have talked about this over the weeks, but that's a great point to make, that all of these airlines are going, you know, having gone bust, puts a little bit more elasticity into the system than we had maybe even 2 months ago.
Well, I mean, you have to bear in mind, and we do, that, you know, the last air traffic growth numbers, and I think maybe we mentioned this last week, you know, March was a robust 3.5%, right? And, you know, down from 5.5% the month before that. And if you go back over the kind of the preceding quarter, if you will, at least the preceding 4 months, you're averaging down actually quite a bit, right? And that's at least in part because of, you know, what's been going on with the airlines, like Thomas Cook or Jet, you name it. The other thing I might add, though, along the lines of Richard's comments, there really isn't any alternative to Boeing aircraft or Airbus aircraft. So unless China were to want to inflict, you know, its own self-harm by impacting its own economic growth by not having enough lift, that's, I mean, and maybe they'd want to do that. I mean, outside of something going wrong that, you know, in the negotiations, you know, if they just want to, you know, not have enough lift to support their own economic growth, I suppose that's their choice. But that seems pretty unlikely, that because there isn't a domestic alternative, they're not going to go buy a bunch of super jets, right? There really is only one place to go, or two places to go. They go to Airbus or Boeing. It seems like, I think Richard's view is probably pretty right on.
And Embraer is unlikely to be able to surge. I mean, that also helps, you know, Boeing ultimately as well, right? I mean, so if you want it to be totally punitive, it's not like you'd suddenly turn to the Brazilians, given that the Brazilians are partners with Boeing on.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose you could, but I mean, ultimately, you know, Embraer makes about 100 airplanes a year. So if they were to go to 150 airplanes a year, that's surging for them, but that's really not going to fill much demand.
That's 1 month's production for Boeing out of Renton.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's kind of a rounding error in a sense, said respectfully. And the same thing for the A220. I mean, they just don't make that many.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the simulators story very quickly before we move on to whether or not, because the Financial Times had a story, you know, questioning whether or not Dennis Muilenburg, the chief executive of Boeing, is going to survive this. I know that we've glanced on that before. But talk to us a little bit, Ron, about the simulator story that was in the New York Times, that evidently the MAX simulator does not behave like the real airplane. While the military has a tendency of living with simulators that actually don't behave anything like the real airplane, right? I mean, the C2 community, the Greyhound community knew that for many decades, you know, their simulator for the E2C2 did not really behave like the real airplane. It was difficult, but different than the real airplane. And everybody, when they were, you know, got to their squadron, like learned what the real airplane was like. But that's very unacceptable in the commercial world. Talk to us about the potential implications here.
Yeah, right. So you're dead on right. I mean, probably a key difference between the military world and the civilian world is even just the reliance on simulation based, you know, training. You know, it's in some, to some extent, widespread simulator training in the military is a little bit more of a new age thing, where it's been kind of core for, you know, civil aviation for a very long time. And that civil simulator has to feel exactly like the real plane. I mean, it's just kind of how it is. And you need to be able to simulate all the failures. Now, a couple interesting points, right? If you look at the simulators available for MAXes, I believe today there's only 15 in the world. And by the end of the year, maybe we'll have 20. The industry, you know, so that would be CAE, flight safety, true simulation at Textron, could surge and supply more simulators if need be. Another couple interesting factoids. When you look at a simulator, those companies that built those simulators, they did not make the binary for the simulator. So the binary is what makes, it's the guts that kind of makes it, you know, feel like a 737 MAX. That was actually supplied by Boeing. So, you know, if indeed, that was news to me in that article, if indeed that is the case, then that was another, mishap on Boeing's part by not having that in the simulator binary. And maybe it makes sense that they overlooked it because they didn't obviously think it would happen in the live airplane, right? So anyway, but that would have to be fixed as well. And then another piece that may not be fully appreciated, converting a 737 NG simulator to a 737 MAX simulator is a very big job, right? So it's almost as difficult as just making a simulator from scratch from beginning. So one of the areas when the aircraft it will probably come out of this May 23rd meeting we talked about is different regulators in different regions of the world will probably have different expectations about training. And, you know, one of the bottlenecks on training will be the number of MAX simulators available in the world. There's just not that many.
I want to just go to our sponsor. And now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. Sash, Richard, do you guys have anything you want to add?
I mean, I'd just highlight there was a very, very good article on Aviation Week about, you know, looking at the issue of simulation and the degree to which a US 737 MAX crew trying to, emulate the Ethiopians flight 302 couldn't survive. They couldn't actually make it work, which suggests that there's a problem with the simulator, but the data that was in the simulator, or the way the simulator was behaving, suggested that with MCAS set up like that, that was not a survivable situation to be in. And therefore, this isn't an issue of pilot training. It's an issue that MCAS needs to be very, very different indeed. But I agree with Ron. I think different regulatory organizations are around the world are going to take very different views of how much simulator time pilots are going to need, and this is going to damage the competitiveness of the MAX.
Richard, do you agree with that sentiment?
I'm not really convinced of it because, frankly, you know what they need to do to MCAS is pretty substantial. It sounds like they're doing something quite substantial, and that would change everything we're talking about here. The argument over the simulators, correct me if I'm wrong, anybody, this seems to be over the degree to which airmanship was to blame for the Ethiopian crash. That's kind of what's in play here. And good people can debate that. But to me, well, it's a number of factors, including MCAS, possibly including airmanship. Good argument for that. It's a combination of things. in the future, moving forward, this will be a completely different MCAS. Now, there's a further argument to be made that MCAS shouldn't play any kind of really active role. It should just be a warning, like a stick shaker. There's an interesting letter in Aviation Week this week making that argument. I'm not so sure I'd go that far, but either way, you're talking about a very different MCAS moving forward. So I think it's too early to say that this debate is going to affect Max's competitiveness moving forward.
I just want to say, as a longtime crash reporter, I am very unclear whether or not airmanship played a factor in the Ethiopia crash. I mean, by all accounts, it looks like the guys were trying to do their level best, and the folks are recognizing the forces required to try to correct the airplane when MCAS, whether it is or isn't engaged, is monumental in terms of all the things that you have to do. And these guys, even if you have 8,000 hours, you're not an experimental test pilot who on the spur can be like, okay, here's what I have to do all of a sudden in order to be able to. I mean, they had a couple of minutes to figure out why an airplane that was supposed to behave exactly like the airplane that they had 8,000 hours in was not behaving the way that that airplane was supposed to behave. And that's a little bit fundamental. And I say that as somebody who, you know, doesn't have a lot of like actual flying experience. I'm very limited on that, but a lot of time in simulators. And, you know, if you're not expecting an airplane to behave a certain way and there's no flight instructor right there to tell you what you should do, it can become a very, very surprising situation if you're sitting on it. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about the FT story and whether or not Dennis Muhlenberg survives. Ron, you know, you have your ear on the market. You know, what are you hearing from investors about what could be the future for Boeing's chief executive, who by all accounts is seen as, you know, a guy who's done a very credible job, but, you know, big crises can sometimes claim very capable people?
Yeah, I mean that question's clearly come up in the investment community. However, I think, you know, the market itself is the ultimate judge, right? And, you know, Boeing stock, all things considered, you know, this crisis going on and even the China backdrop, the stock has actually held in pretty well. I mean, it's off a lot from its peak, but, you know, relative to the market and kind of year-to-date performance, all things considered, the stock's actually done pretty well, right? So, I mean, I think if the stock was you know, materially lower, you know, Dennis's future might be more in question, but given where the stock is today, I don't think there's going to be a steady drumbeat, at least from the investment community, you know, along those lines.
Sash, what are people in London saying?
The share price is the judge at the moment, but there is clearly a concern about leadership as opposed to engineering in the whole Max scenario, which is, you know, which I think is going to be an issue for the board to think about, you know, particularly if we get a fairly messy return of the aircraft into service.
Richard, anything you want to add?
No, I completely agree with Ron. Everything about this company is driven by the share price these days, for better or worse, and that will determine whether or not Muhlenberg lasts.
Do we have any guidance or any modeling that tells us how much this is ultimately going to end up costing the company, or is this an incalculable number at this point?
Well, you can try to make your best, you know, estimates on it, and we have, you know, so these are numbers that, you know, we have in print. I mean, you got to put them, like, it's a, you know, put bounds on it, right?
But right,
if you think about the level of inventory they're going to collect, right, depending on how long this goes on. You know, our model assumes that it's, you know, they don't deliver airplanes for about 6 months. So you build up a lot of inventory, you know, on the order of kind of, you know, $10 billion worth of inventory. And then when you go and look at, all right, so there's, you know, 370 aircraft or whatever the precise number was that were grounded, that were in service, those aircraft will potentially be very expensive from a, you know, a penalty liability point of view. Because the airlines that were operating those aircraft had crews, infrastructure, everything was set up. I mean, they were flying. So they couldn't, you know, the cost structure tied to those airplanes, you can't immediately reverse. I would imagine many of those airlines, if not all of them, will, you know go for some, you know, approach Boeing for, you know, some sort of settlement regarding that. Our guess on that is it's probably something like, $750,000 per month per airplane. And then the aircraft that aren't delivered, that they are easier for an airline to manage ultimately, right? Because they weren't in service and then were just parked. But they'll have a cost to them too. And our guess there, based on, alternative lift plus the cost difference between alternative lift and, the business interruption piece isn't as big with those aircraft, but they're probably 350, 400,000 per month. So you add it all up on a 6 month view, it's probably somewhere on the order of $3 billion of liabilities and penalties. And then on top of that, Boeing probably does have some sort of insurance for it. Our best guess on a grounding event, they maybe have about $500 million of insurance. So you net out the insurance, it's probably maybe a $2.5 billion exposure.
And of course, construction is still going on. Where are they sticking all of these airplanes, by the way?
From what we understand, they ran out of room in the Seattle region, and now they're parking them down in Texas.
Wow. And they do have a certificate to fly them down, right? I mean, the manufacturer can still fly them as long as they don't have revenue passengers on them, right?
I think that's correct, yeah.
Anything that Sash or you, Richard, want to add to this conversation before we move on to BAE's Capital Markets Day?
No, I'm good.
Good.
Sash, talk to us a little bit about BAE's big day and some of the news flow, some of which was positive and some of which was maybe less than positive.
Yeah, okay. BAE Systems, Europe's largest defense contractor, US number 5/6, slightly depending on how you count it and which year. Capital Markets Day this week at their big Wharton combat aircraft facility. And there was some very, very interesting stuff that came out of it. In no particular order, that in the US, their land systems business clearly had a really tough year last year with the M106 Paladin PIM self-propelled howitzer program. And it was very interesting how I would say scarred management were by the experience of what they thought was a relatively straightforward, albeit very large upgrade program for large armored vehicles. It really didn't ramp. It had big quality problems, and they're learning a ton of stuff about producing large armored vehicles from scratch, as opposed to upgrading existing ones that I think they wish they didn't have to learn. Over in Europe, the two big stories there. One, exports to Saudi. Germany is still the issue there. I don't get the feeling that any European country is going to look at Germany as a manufacturing partner for a defense program in quite the same way in the future as they did previously. Germany has an ability to let politics get in the way of an existing industrial structure and an existing political agreement, and that causes a whole world of pain in terms of exports. Most interesting possibly was the company's comments on the Tempest future combat aircraft program, which is competing head on with the Franco-German SCAF FCAS program. And what I was really interested by was quite how aggressive the timescale is on Tempest. It's designed to get well inside the decision-making timescale of SCAF. And at the moment, I think it is doing exactly that. You hear comments from Dassault bemoaning the fact that a bilateral program, again, with the Germans, just takes longer to do everything. But Tempest has also got a very aggressive development time scale. And I think this is where companies like Saab come in. Saab are clearly very keen, and Sweden is very keen, to become part of the Tempest program. I think they want to bring to Tempest what arguably they brought to TX. And indeed have got with their Gripen E program, which is fantastic, low-cost, short-time-scale development and manufacturing technologies. And if they and BAE can do that, and BAE has got some absolutely stunning emergent technologies in terms of additive manufacturing that will, I think, cause havoc among the titanium forging companies. I just don't want to be a titanium forger in the future, because I think emerging technology is going to reduce that market substantially. But if BAE can bring that sort of thing through, then you could well see 10% entering service in the 2035 time scale. And that's at least 5 years ahead of SCAF. And they are focusing on some, you know, some of the key export markets in that time scale. It's going to be very, very interesting. But I was really taken aback by quite how aggressive the Tempest program is. And also, frankly, how well funded it is at the moment. You know, the UK government is up for 2 billion. Industry is probably up for thick end of a billion sterling. That's a lot to get a program going at this stage.
Well, I mean, and again, I mean, I think the mistake people made at Farnborough last year was this assumption that the UK had worked on it as a black program for 3 years before that airplane was unveiled. There had been money in it, a lot of very, very clever thinking and engineering, specifically to position it as the program that saves the UK high-end aerospace industry, defense aerospace industry. So I think it was a very, very admirable sort of effort. Richard, I want to bring you in because there isn't a combat aircraft or even civil program around the world that you don't pay close attention to. Do you think the Brits are going to have a real shot at changing the dynamic with the program ultimately? Because you're sometimes skeptical that some of these efforts are as successful ultimately as everybody hopes they will. But it seems like both the company and the British government are being very, very serious about this to the point where everybody else is noticing. I mean, what's your sense about where this is all going to go and what Sash just said?
I agree completely with Sash. I think Tempest is a work of genius. I really, you know, I'm not used to speaking without irony, but I'm going to make
it. Yeah.
Whoa.
Wait a minute. Everybody should buckle down, because normally there's always some form of cleverly scathing commentary by Richard on things like this. So you saying genius that without irony is actually pretty good.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fantastic way of, yeah, exactly what Sash said, getting inside the FCAS loop. Because frankly, if Tempest is a work of genius, FCAS is the most geopolitically foolish idea in history. I mean, the entire selling point of a French fighter is you don't need to ask to use it. Just go ahead. And Germany, again, as Sash says, increasingly is showing itself to be this arms provider that says, well, you can use it anytime you ask politely for the keys. And the idea of reconciling these two diametrically opposite approaches in a joint combat aircraft program is beyond foolish. And it only exists because of Brexit. The idea that, you know, Britain is not going to be a part of a pan-European fighter program anymore because of Brexit, which is a one-time spasm. The future, with or without Brexit, watered down or not, is going to include Britain. Sweden and Italy see this. They're joining Britain. Germany will see it too. They fit in far better with Britain than they do with France when it comes to a combat aircraft program. So France will go its own way and Britain will lead the Tempest. And frankly, they'll be able to increase their market share of this future pan-European fighter program because they have the wisdom to invest in this far more logical future.
Do you think that this is a real undoing of France's rather and Dassault's rather meticulous plans to put itself into the center? Do you think, is it fair to say that it's completely backfired at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to make hard to know what to make of France's plans, because, you know, I suspect they probably looked at the broader European initiative and said, well, you know, the way it works is we get the Germans to pay for a fair percentage of things and we actually keep, you know, a fair amount of the work in France. But the more you look at the structure of the French combat aircraft industry, it's the most single vertical military business in the world, maybe outside of Russia. I mean, it is inconceivable that the motor won't come from Safran. It is inconceivable that the electronic warfare package and other avionics won't come from Thales. There'll be a little chunk here thrown to MTU and a little bit here thrown to, I don't know, Airbus, I suppose. But in reality, it's a Franco-French fighter. And the idea that the Germans would pay for this and that the French would tolerate this little role in exchange for giving the Germans some kind of oversight as to where and how it's sold and supported, none of this makes any sense whatsoever.
Ron, anything you or Sash, anything you guys want to add to that? Because I know we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I also want to talk about CAE's first quarter returns. Anything to add, Ron, in terms of the assessment we've gotten as to what the fighter market is going to look like and what the UK role in it is going to be?
No, I mean, I think, yeah, you know, Sash and Richard hit that pretty nailed right on the head.
Let me just quickly ask one more question, because something that Sash said, which is interesting, BAE, Boeing, Lockheed, company after company has been working on additive manufacturing techniques that are absolutely cutting edge. And I remember going back about 10 years ago that there were some folks who were able to do this to produce bearing quality material without any machining, which was kind of the big game change, right? And so many of these aerospace complex parts manufacturers survived on casting, machining, six axis, all of that. Does this market completely implode, a market that for decades has been a very key and very value add part of the defense and aerospace ecosystem?
I mean, jump in on that one. No. Okay. Right. I mean, just because I think, you know, our friends at GE used to have an advertisement and it kind of looked like you could 3D print an entire engine. Well, it turns out that's not the case. I mean, there's components you'll be able to, right? And, you know, 3D printing, you know, might change the landscape a little bit. But I mean, you know, it's going to depend on the different methodology you use to shape metal or, you know, components. It'll depend on, you know, the component, the metallurgy, so on and so forth. Some things will make sense to print. Some things will make sense to cast. Some things will make sense to forge. It's just for a lack of better cliches, it's just another tool in the quiver of tools that they'll have to use, right? But, you know, is it going to, you know, radically reshape the entire industry? No.
CAE, 30 seconds. Tell us what they told you.
Yeah, so CAE had, you know, had a great quarter. I think probably the most interesting thing there, though, you know, their outlook for organic growth in, you know, their training and simulation business on the commercial side, year over year going into this next fiscal year is up 20%, right? And I think that just speaks volumes to a couple things. You know, I always hate to call it the pilot shortage, but there is a kind of a secular issue around a growing fleet, growing air traffic, and a need for more pilots. And as Richard reminds us, just pay them more and you'll get more pilots. I think that's true. But even if you pay them more, they all got to get trained somehow, right? So, you know, there's this secular thing going on where there is a need for more pilots and they're benefiting from that. And then one thing I might add, depending on how everything plays out with the MAX in different regions of the world, there might be a lot of demand for MAX simulators. So just something to bear in mind. But we're really starting to see the training market really begin to get pretty hot because of the need for pilots around the world.
Anything you guys want to add before we end it for the week?
Oh, maybe one quick thing that I didn't mention earlier. There was also another hearing on the Hill besides the FAA hearing. TransDigm's management was on the Hill. And in the end, I mean, kind of my takeaway from that was that looked like a little bit of political kabuki going on. Recently there was an investigator general report put out on TransDigm. And I think the U.S. government wanted them to volunteer back $16 million that they considered kind of an excessive pricing. Yes, $16 million. And anyway, that ended up at a hearing on the Hill, and there was a lot of political noise. But in the end, I don't think it's really going to amount to much. But I'm still astounded that $16 million out of a $700 billion defense budget. $16 million, $700 billion. But we'll just leave it there.
Anything you guys want to add before we end it for the week?
That's good for me.
Lovely. Guys, thanks very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Great to be here, Vago.
Yeah, great to be here, Vago.
Yeah.
And thanks for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Check out my conversation with U.S. Army Secretary Mark Esper at the Atlantic Council last week, and check out our coverage of the Navy League Sea Airspace Conference and Trade Show, where our coverage was sponsored by GE Marine, Huntington Ingalls Industries, and Leonardo DRS. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report. And like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is sponsored by Bell. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight. BellFlight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you next week.